From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
Well, the Illinois legislature will be back in Springfield next week to wrap up the fall veto session. It is still unclear what will happen. We'll talk about some of the possibilities. And also we'll get the latest from Chicago on what's going on there. A lot of things playing out in the courts when it comes to immigration enforcement. That and more ahead on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel includes Charlie Wheeler, Professor Emeritus and former Director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie's also been a longtime reporter and observer. And our guest this week, it's good to have back with us, Brendan Moore, a reporter now with Capital News Illinois. So congratulations on the new job, Brendan, and thanks for joining us.
Happy to join you guys.
So first this week, before we get talking about other things, I did want to extend condolences to Darren Bailey and his family. Bailey, of course, is a former state senator. He was the GOP nominee for governor in 2022, and he's running again. He lost a son, daughter-in-law, and two grandchildren in a helicopter crash that happened in Montana this week. A terrible situation. Charlie, I was glad to see some politicians, including Governor Pritzker and others, extend their sympathies. And this is a situation, I think, where, you know, it's not about politics. And I think we can all show some compassion in these moments, even though maybe you don't agree on a lot of issues. So it just sort of puts things a little more into perspective.
And it was interesting. On Capitol Facts, there was a section, and it had condolences being expressed by people from every part of the state, from the different political parties, the different leaders. And that's the kind of thing that brings people together. I mean, I'm blessed. I have three kids and two grandkids. And to me, the losing any one of them would just be unimaginable. It's just a kind of tragedy. There's words just can't explain it. When something like this happens, you realize that all this other stuff that we get involved in and it takes up our time and we think it's oh so important, you know, this bill or this plank or this campaign, in the long run, it's really not as significant as your family. And so I'm guessing that any political figure would just as soon lose every election, lose every bill, rather than lose a member of their family. And as you said, Sean, it's just an unimaginable tragedy. And my heart goes out to Darren Bailey and his family. It's the worst thing that can possibly happen to anybody.
Yeah, it shouldn't take these circumstances, I think, for us to treat each other with respect. And that goes for both parties. And even those that don't follow politics, you can fight like hell over certain issues, but show some compassion. It should be, I always say, less about the political race, more about the human race. Okay, with that being said, let's move on to, as we look ahead to the legislature coming in again next week for the fall veto session, the last time they'll be in session, it appears, until sometime early next year. A lot of things are still on the table, Brendan. You've been following a lot of this. One of those is the state Democrats getting some pressure to do a new congressional map, one that would help that party in the U.S. House, maybe blunt some of the similar Republican efforts to gain more seats. But is this idea getting any traction here in Illinois?
Simply put, not really, Sean. I mean, this is really a Washington, D.C. driven conversation right now. And the only reason that we're having it is because President Trump has essentially goaded Republican states into redrawing their maps. So it's happened in Texas, in North Carolina, in Missouri. It might happen in Kansas, maybe in Florida, a few other places. And Democrats have a few options to counteract, most notably California. And we saw earlier this week, perhaps even in Virginia. But besides that, they're kind of limited. And Illinois presents an opportunity where maybe they can get one more seat. Now, mind you, Illinois is already one of the most partisanly gerrymandered states in the country. It's a 14-3 split in favor of Democrats. And this is a state, again, where President Trump won about 43-44% of the vote in 2024. So the proportion doesn't really match out. That being said, there is an opportunity for Democrats, if they wanted to make it a 15-2 map. But those lines that are pretty ugly right now would have to get even uglier. And there's not much of an appetite for it under the dome, to be quite blunt. Speaker Welch and Senate President Harman have said through their spokespeople that they haven't seen any maps. They have not initiated a process to create new maps. This is, again, coming completely from Washington, from House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, who is understandably concerned with some of the Republican moves in other states about whether or not what the impact might be on their chances to take back the House in 2026. It's very close. I believe Republicans have about a 5-seat advantage right now, and the playing field is very limited. So any move a few seats one direction or the other could have a significant impact. Again, it's looking very, very unlikely that anything happens. They would have to act next week. And even then, the timing doesn't really work out because the filing period for to get on the ballot for the March primary is it starts next week. The deadline is November 3rd. So you would either have to move the primary back, or you would have to change some of the petition signature requirements. It would kind of be a logistical nightmare. And not to mention that there are concerns about, if you try to go for a 15-2 Democratic map, that might put some current legislators, some incumbents in danger. If you stretch it out too thin, then you have some significant concerns from Black lawmakers who believe that a new map could impact Black political representation in Washington, because a lot of there would have to be likely have to be a dilution of Black majority districts in order to get this extra seat. So I think a lot of legislators have kind of determined that they've kind of maxed out what they can do in terms of a gerrymander, that 14-3 is good enough. They waited too long, and especially from Springfield Democrats' perspective, the negatives really seem to outweigh the positives here.
Yeah, Charlie, we've seen things get messed with before. We've seen the primary date moved. I remember that was done in some ways to help Barack Obama when he ran for president. So we've seen some changes, but this is a pretty big, heavy lift for Democrats in this state, especially like Brendan said, at this point in time, because they have waited so long. So unlikely this is going to happen, right?
Yeah, I would say the chances are zero and none. And the reason I said that is a couple of reasons. One is just the logistics of it. You would have to basically move the primary date, change the filing dates, and that would require legislation, and it would require a three-fifths vote for it to become effective before January 1st. And as the stories have suggested, and as Brendan pointed out, if you're going to try and create new Democratic districts, basically you're going to have to stretch out districts that are in Chicago and bring them out further to the south and to the west and to the northwest, and you're going to be diluting the Black legislative, what would you say, the Black representation. Right now, I think Brendan reported that there are something like three of the current congressional districts have at least 40% African American, and we have four Black representatives in Congress. Now, if you were to stretch those districts out, there's the possibility that they would not be able to, the Black community would not be able to elect someone of their choosing. The other side of it is also, you look at some of the downstate districts, like the district that we live here in Springfield. Nikki Budzinski is the congressperson. It's a district that zigzags basically from Champaign-Urbana down through Democratic areas in Decatur, Democratic parts of Springfield, on down to the Metro East. And it looks, from one vantage point, it looks like a lightning bolt hit the state and split it. Now, if you try to create districts that will elect more Democrats, you run the risk of possibly interfering with the district of someone like Budzinski. So I don't think it's going to happen. The logistics are too difficult at this point, and the impact on the black representation would be too dramatic. Plus, you get one seat. Is it worth all the effort? Now, it might be. On the other hand, as Brendan mentioned, in Virginia, they're doing it, and they're going to pick up three seats, they think. One final thought. If I were in charge, I would make a rule, make like a federal law. The federal law should read that you redistrict after the decennial census, and that's it. Because otherwise, we'll get to a situation like every couple of years, if the leadership of a state changes, they can try and redistrict to benefit their own people. And that would just be such an abomination in my judgment. So I would be very much in favor of saying you redistrict following the federal census, and that's it.
Yeah, I think Indiana, there's been talk that Republicans have been putting pressure on lawmakers there to try to gain two additional Republican seats. But the last thing I saw, I believe Politico reported this week, that that was going to be a pretty hard thing to get approved there as well. They didn't have the votes at that point, so we'll have to wait and see. As I mentioned, though, the session will resume. Lawmakers set to be here for 3 days next week. Brendan, there's a lot of other topics there, and rather than me run all of those down, I guess I should ask you, do we expect anything of some of these more more publicized topics to actually get addressed here in the next few days?
I think that a few of the big issues that we've been talking about will be addressed, or at least the ball will be moved. The chances of an omnibus energy bill passing look pretty good. Not as big as what they were talking about in the spring, but we should see something to address the battery storage issue for renewable energy, trying to, I guess, speed up that development, try to speed up some of these projects that have been kind of in the pipeline, but haven't been able to get off the ground. I would expect something on that next week. Then obviously there's the conversation about public transportation, reforming the Chicago area transit agencies and providing a new funding mechanism for transit agencies across the whole state. The first week of veto session, it didn't seem like there was much movement from where we were in the spring, but those conversations are continuing. It seems like there's agreement on the reforms to the governance structure. It's just a matter of finding the right, I guess, menu of funding options. The House Speaker during the first week of veto session basically said that the delivery tax on Amazon and DoorDash, et cetera, at least as it was proposed in the Senate passed bill in May, is a non-starter. So they're gonna have to find additional ways to fund these agencies. And so I think that's kind of where the conversations are at right now. So I feel less confident about that, especially given the RTA's report earlier this month that the fiscal cliff this year is more of a hill, if you want to call it that. They've gotten it down from about $750 million to about $200 million next year. So the real pain is further down the line. So they could, in theory, wait until the spring to address that. So I guess we're gonna have to wait and see on that. Another thing that will be interesting to watch is whether there's any concrete action taken in response to some of these aggressive immigration raids that we've seen, especially in the Chicago region over the past month. There's been a few, some ideas put out there, not necessarily in bill form yet, but some talk about basically banning civil immigration arrests in state courthouses. There are a couple of other proposals that around the edges that would kind of be a legislative response. The state is very limited in what it can do because, federal authority is hard to get around. And they did pass a series of resolutions basically condemning ICE action in Chicago during the first week of veto session. But, those are basically just strongly worded statements. So I think legislators want to do something more substantive than that. And there's been talks of a package coming together on that. One other thing I will mention too, this is kind of maybe a little bit lower on the agenda, but I have heard on pretty good authority that there will be legislation that would authorize a Racino for Decatur and would remove a provision in the 2019 gaming law that allowed for Hawthorne Racecourse in Chicago to have essentially a veto power over the development of any Racino project in Southern Cook County. That is pretty significant for the state's horse racing industry, which it has struggled significantly in recent years. But there could be some movement on that. So there are some things happening that we should expect to happen next week. I don't know if everything on the agenda will get done, but it will certainly be more active than it was the first week of veto session. And I do think they will leave Springfield having actually passed some legislation and sending it off to Governor Pritzker's desk.
And Charlie, also, when as Brendan mentioned, the legislation sort of targeted at ICE and some of the immigration enforcement that's been going on in the Chicago area. Of course, this follows on the fact that Governor Pritzker also this week announcing creation of the Illinois Accountability Commission. He says it's to document examples of harassment, intimidation, and abuse by federal agents in the Chicago area, and says a panel will hold hearings, take testimony from people who have suffered abuses at the hands of federal agents. So it seems as though I'd be surprised if they don't leave doing at least something to sort of call attention to this. I don't know your thoughts on that, Charlie.
Yeah, I think basically the commission is going to be advisory in the sense that it doesn't really have any authority to be able to tell ICE what it can and can't do. And the object is more or less to provide people with an opportunity to report what's going on in their communities, the abuses that they think are occurring, that they see occurring at the hands of ICE and the Border Patrol, and document all this stuff. The panel is going to hold hearings, gather testimony from legal experts, local officials, faith leaders, and others. And they're going to do an initial report in January, according to the announcement from the governor's office. It's, as I say, it's more advisory. The chair of the commission is going to be a former U.S. District Judge, Chief Judge Ruben Castillo, and there's others that are appointed that have credentials in the area. Now, the House Republican leader, Tony McComey, blasted the idea, saying she called it just another taxpayer-funded political stunt. From my perspective, this commission will hold hearings and it will compile a report pointing out all the things that will be considered to be abuses of federal authority. Whether or not it will lead to anything remains to be seen. It could just as well wind up being an advisory thing.
And Brendan, I know a lot of people are having trouble keeping track because there's been a lot of court action taking place in the last several days or so, including a federal judge issuing a restraining order on allowing National Guard troops to be deployed into Chicago streets. They can, I guess, be there, but they can't go out and do any work while they're there, according to the judge. And that has now been appealed all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And this week, the Trump administration has agreed to allow that restraining order to stay in effect until the High Court rules on it, which, could come sometime soon here. But basically, we're in a bit of a holding pattern, right, when it comes to the guard.
That's right. So this was an extension of the temporary restraining order that was issued earlier this month, basically just acknowledging that this is going way up the chain, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and they're going to have the final word on this. And so this just kind of leaves in place the order that kind of, as you said, puts us in a holding pattern. Hopefully we will hear soon. The case has been expedited, but so for the next however long it takes the Supreme Court to make a decision, the guard can remain in Illinois, but they can't really do much. They can't really do what the administration activated them to do. So, kind of a wait and see until we get word from the Supreme Court.
And Charlie, in some cases, I'm not sure how much it matters what the courts say, because there's also a judge who's weighed in on some of the tactics that ICE was using, and yet we're continuing to see those, even though the judge says they can't do them. Things like tear gas, for example. We saw that this week.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, just a couple of days ago, there was a lawsuit filed accusing the Border Patrol commander, Gregory Bovino, of violating a temporary restraining order against using tear gas and other non-lethal munitions against people who are demonstrating. The attorneys in the lawsuit said that Bovino has violated the court order by personally throwing tear gas toward a crowd of protesters during an operation at Little Village neighborhood in Chicago. And the filing alleges that Bovino violated multiple paragraphs of a restraining order that U.S. District Judge Sarah Ellis put out restricting when and how tear gas can be deployed against the media, religious leaders, other protesters. And so that's an example of, from my perspective, of where the feds don't care what the justice or what the judges say. They're going to do whatever the heck they want to. And another interesting thing that came out, Secretary of State Alexis Janoulias created a hotline to investigate license plate violations. And that stems from the fact that the feds don't follow the rules in Illinois for displaying license plates. The license plates have been tampered with, obscured, swapped out on federal law enforcement officers as they go through making these sweeps to arrest people. In a video, Janoulias pointed to the words of a federal officer who told a bystander who was recording him, "You can record all you want. We change our plates every other day." Janoulias says, "I have zero tolerance for this type of illegal activity. We're investigating these allegations. Flipping license plate or altering them in any way is strictly prohibited in Illinois." And he pointed out, "No one, including a federal agent, is above the law."
Brendan, maybe you can give us a quick update on this, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty crowded GOP primary field for governor next year. Looks like another candidate now maybe jumping in. Fill us in on who that is.
Earlier this week, a businessman named Rick Heidner filed paperwork to join the race for Republican race for governor. Heidner is a real estate guy. He's also owner of the third largest video gambling terminal operating company in the state of Illinois. So those are the machines you see in the bars and restaurants. He is a wealthy guy. We don't know a whole lot about him, though, about kind of what his ideology is, what types of issues he is going to run on. In that sense, he's kind of a blank slate, maybe akin to a Bruce Rauner in a sense, but we haven't heard from him yet, so he's a little bit of a mystery. So he's come up in some news stories over the years, was involved in some business dealings with a bank that had purported mob ties. His name showed up in a federal search warrant on former state senator Marty Sandoval's Springfield offices and a sweeping political corruption probe. He was not a target, though, of that. He had a federal tax lien of $5 million back in 2019. So, he not just what's publicly available. He's gonna have to answer for a lot of these a lot of these things that have come up. Maybe even more so in a more of an issue in a Republican primary is his record of campaign donations. He's given to Republicans, but he's also given to a lot of Democrats, including Chicago Mayor Brandon Johnson, Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle, and a few others. And he enters a what's becoming a crowded field with Senator Darren Bailey, Ted Dabrowski, DuPage County Sheriff Jim Mendrick, and now Rick Heidner. Again, he just announced this week, filing deadline is November 3rd. So he's going to have to really hustle to get at least 5,000 signatures to secure his place on the ballot.
It's time now for our notes from the field. Brendan, we'll stay with you this week.
Yeah, so earlier this week, the Illinois State Board of Elections held a hearing on Senate President Don Harmon's $10 million fine that was assessed for improper campaign contributions. He allegedly accepted $4 million more than was allowed during the 2024 election cycle. But the eight-person board deadlocked. It was a 4-4 vote. The board is bipartisan, equal number Republicans, equal number of Democrats. All the Democrats sided with Harmon, all the Republicans voted against him, and created a lot of confusion because nobody really knew if it meant Harmon, that the fine that the Board of Elections officer assessed stood, or whether Harmon doesn't have to pay it. His attorney indicated that, you know, he would challenge it in court, but he has no standing right now because there is no affirmative vote from the Board of Elections. So it's kind of a mess, but at least the top line right now is that it seems like President Harmon might skate by without having to pay this very hefty fine.
All right. And Charlie?
Well, the legislature's fiscal gurus, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, released its latest update on wagering in Illinois, and it showed that in the last fiscal year, 2025, the state's share of tax revenues from wagering in Illinois totaled $2.2 billion, up almost 7% over FY24. The most significant increases came in the video gaming and sports wagering industries. Also, for the first time in a couple of decades, the video gaming beat out the lottery as the number one source of revenue. The lottery generated $789 million last fiscal year, and the video gaming industry generated $871 million. And the CAGFA report noted that the number of video gaming terminals has been increasing, and it's now more than 49,000. Interestingly enough, Chicago doesn't have video gaming terminals officially. And so in regard to municipalities, Springfield, again, has the most terminals, 864, and the highest amount of net terminal income, $54 million to the city from these terminals. And that number does not include the ones in some of our, quote, suburbs.
All right. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler and Capital News Illinois' Brendan Moore. Look for State Week where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Join us next time.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capital by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.